From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I thought it would be inspirational to others, both to mothers trying to raise single boys by themselves, which was the case with my mother, who raised four boys by herself, and also for youth who were looking for direction and looking for a way out and a way to overcome the obstacles. So that was the purpose of writing the biography, Inner City Miracle. And then I had a novel loosely based on my time as a judge in Detroit called Street Judge. And that was giving some insight into the inner workings of the justice system as well as politics where I came from, which is where I earned my bones, if you will, in my career. And so those are the reasons I wrote those books, once again, to provide insight into the justice system and, of course, to inspire.
The Honorable Greg Mathis, former Superior Court Judge for Michigan's 36th District Court and host of the long-running reality TV courtroom program, Judge Mathis. Judge Mathis has been extremely fortunate, now entering his 19th season on television. Most courtroom programs like his have a limited shelf life. Judge Mathis is the second longest serving court show arbitrator and the longest serving African American arbitrator in courtroom reality television. Also, Judge Mathis is one of only two who have hosted their program from the beginning. As the youngest judge in Michigan history, Judge Mathis brought a common sense approach to the bench. He was known as the Judge of Second Chances. That same compassion is on display in his reality TV courtroom. I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the Honorable Greg Mathis, In Black America.
My first contract wasn't very much more than what I made on the bench in Detroit. So it wasn't necessarily the money. It was the ability to affect change and inspire folks throughout the country by using television as that platform.
Judge Greg Mathis is known for his compassion and his advocacy campaigns for urban youth and equal justice. His inspirational life story of a streetwise youth who rose from jail to judge has provided hope to millions who watch him on the Emmy-nominated, award-winning reality television courtroom program, Judge Mathis. Born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, Judge Mathis grew up in the Herman Gardens housing project on the Motor City's northwest side. Following his estranged father's footsteps, he joined the Earl Flynn's street gang that led him to being incarcerated in the Wayne County Jail. While in jail, his mother gave him the bad news. She had colon cancer. That method changed his life around. He went on to Eastern Michigan University, and in 1987, he earned a law degree from the University of Detroit Mercy. Pastor Barmy became the youngest judge in Michigan history when he was elected in 1995, to the 36th District Court. Recently, In Black America spoke with Judge Mathis regarding the upcoming 19th season of his reality-based television program and lessons learned along the way.
I'll put it nicely. I was a troubled youth in Detroit, and most people know that story. I was in and out of juvenile, and my last contact as an adult was the court system. I changed my life as the judge ordered and went to college. And ultimately, after law school, my law license was withheld for 3 years because of my background, even though it had been expunged. And I went and won my license to practice at the Michigan Supreme Court. So it was a struggle.
What was it about the law that sparked your interest?
Civil rights and equal justice. When I first got to college, you know, I'd grown up in an all-African-American neighborhood, impoverished neighborhood. And so when I got to college and I saw the contradiction, all these other kids and college students were living good lives, and I almost, for the most part, didn't know that existed. And so when I saw the contradiction and began to read a lot, it convinced me that I should get involved in the struggle to same type of opportunity to people that come from my background.
Was there an adjustment in your study habits when you attended law school?
Well, in undergrad there was. By the fourth year of undergrad, I was disciplined enough to read those several hours a day that you must read in law school. But yes, the first 2 years was an adjustment. I was still a little rough around the edges and still involved in a little petty things up at college, quite frankly. By my second year, I was a good student, and I was leading marches on campus during that time. It was the anti-apartheid movement. I was the leader of that. I was president of the NAACP in college. So that's the route I pursued, and that's why.
What was the impetus for you to want to sit on the 36th District Judge, the infamous 36th District Court in Detroit?
Sure. I worked for Mayor Young up until the time he retired. Then I began practicing law as a juvenile defense lawyer because I know that that's where I had come from. And I saw that many of the judges weren't giving out second chances, which I received. And secondly, did not understand the challenges and obstacles that inner city youth face. And so I decided I'd run so that I could both be an example to good judging, for lack of a better term, and also an inspiration to those who came before me, giving them alternative sentencing, requiring them to get a GED. If they had that, I'd require them to get a skilled trade or go to community college. I'd require them to go a step beyond high school as part of their probation.
Looking back at your childhood, are there any similarities that you went through that these young people are facing today?
Very much so. The only difference is there weren't as many guns on the street, and that's another political commentary to be discussed. But the fact is, when I was in the street as a street kid, there weren't as many guns. It was pretty tough to get a gun. But by my third year in college, which was 81, I'm sorry, when I went back during the summer, everybody on the street had a 9mm. And ultimately, what we discovered is that the deregulation of the gun laws by Ronald Reagan created an opportunity for anyone to apply for a gun salesman license and get one almost in the mail. And therefore, it flooded the country with semi-automatic weapons as a result. And that's what we've seen in much of the killing.
I also understand that Reverend Jesse Jackson visited you when you were incarcerated.
Yes, and that was another source of inspiration to get involved in the struggle for our folks. And because when he came, I really wasn't familiar with him. And he spoke so powerful about overcoming the inequities in society. You know, I had been a follower of Malcolm X and others, Huey Newton, because that's who appealed to our community. My brothers was a Black Panther, were Black Panthers. And so that was the frame of reference I had for fighting for equal justice. But then later in college, and particularly after kind of consuming some of the things Reverend Jackson recommend we read and catch up on, that played a significant role. And I'm currently the chairman of the board for Reverend Jackson's organization. He performed my daughter's nuptials just this past Saturday. So we're close, some, 30 years later.
Tell us about the Mathis Community Center.
Sure. Right after I left college, I began by holding career development workshops right on the border of the housing projects I grew up in. Went back and used a church to hold workshops, me and a few others, and professional folks that I met after leaving college and some I met during college. And then that grew to ultimately we were getting grants and setting up office space. And once I came to television, I decided I'd invest in a large community center. So we built a 10,000 square foot community center that has since assisted young adults with placement and jobs, career training in college, and secondly, ex-offenders, which we have done the same for, but have most recently had an innovative program where we put them in business for themselves, small franchises, because as many know, there's not a lot of opportunity for ex-offenders. So that's what we do there, among other things. And we have the community have meetings and programs. We have a mentorship program there for youth. And we're doing good things in Detroit, we believe, and helping through that transition.
What was the name of the housing project you grew up in?
The Herman Gardens, Herman Gardens Housing Project.
Judge Mathis, you were a youngster when the 1967 riots took place in Detroit. Did that have an effect on you, or do you remember that time growing up?
It was a tremendous effect, and I believe it had a strong effect on my brothers. The oldest was 10 years older than me, so that would have made him 17. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when he turned toward the Black Panther militant approach because, you know, of that, the oppressive police tactics that we saw in our community all the time and that resulted in the riot. One of the things I will say is that I recall seeing the tanks mm-hmm. roll down our street.
Right,
that was
right.
one of the most profound recollections. At that point, we lived over off Livernois, closer to the riot area. And the next year, 1968, I can recall sitting there in front of the television and watching fires that had occurred after Dr. King's assassination. They were showing fires right. and riots around the country. So those two things had a big impression on me as a child. And then watching my brothers move further into the fight. And then after meeting Reverend Jackson and then going off to college, I determined that I would fight in a little different approach, more of a traditional civil rights approach.
To the best of my knowledge, you were the author of two books. Why was it important for you to put your thoughts on paper?
Well, of course, publishers approached me initially after hearing of my story, and I thought it would be inspirational to others, both to mothers trying to raise single boys by themselves, which was the case with my mother, who raised four boys by herself, and also for youth who were looking for direction and looking for a way out and a way to overcome their obstacles. So that was the purpose of writing the biography, Inner City Miracle. And then I had a novel loosely based on my time as a judge in mm-hmm. Detroit called Street Judge, and that was giving some insight into the inner workings of the justice system, as well as politics, where I came from, which is where I earned my bones, if you will, in my career. And so those are the reasons I wrote those books, once again, to provide insight into the justice system and, of course, to inspire biography, Inner City Miracle.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with the Honorable Judge Greg Mathis, host of the long-running Judge Mathis Show. 19 seasons and growing. Judge Mathis, what brought you to television?
Well, when I ran for judge, I was attacked because of my background as a street youth once again. First time the state bar wouldn't license me. And then this time when I ran, the media came after me. And I had done so much in the community. People
Got
knew
you.
Me. And as a result, I had all the support of the you know, folks who were active in Detroit and the various unions who tried to pick the best candidates. And so I won. I beat a 20-year incumbent by 10,000 votes. And so when I won, it became national news for a couple of days. Did a lot of interviews with national news outlets. And then the producers and agents came calling, wanting to, looking to doing a movie. So for a couple of years, I go out at the behest of agents and producers talking with studios about a movie. And then when we got to Warner Brothers, they said, hey, this Judge Judy is tearing up the airwaves with this guy want to be a judge. And so I said if they were to play my backstory as an introduction to the show, which would once again give some inspiration to others, I said I'd be glad to do it. Folks think that many people leave to go to television because
right.
of money. Well, and in fact, my first contract wasn't very much more than what I made on the bench in Detroit. So it wasn't necessarily the money. It was the ability to affect change and inspire folks throughout the country by using television as that platform.
Speaking of Judge Judy, and you and her have the distinction of being the only two to have hosted their program for their entire run. What makes your program special?
Well, I think it's my ability to relate and speak the language of those who come before me and those who are watching. You know, I try and identify with, and I have the experience to identify with pretty much every litigant that comes before me because
right.
I have, in some way, some similar background, whether it's a street youth, I've been that, whether it's a parent, I am that, whether it's college educated, I'm that. And so I can move back and forth in terms of relating to people. And I guess a little comedy doesn't hurt. So I think that's the relatability factor. In the last several years, probably over a decade, we've assisted people who come before me with drug and alcohol problems. We've assisted them in being placed wherever they live in their in rehab institutions. And many of them come back or write us and thank us because of the success they've had in transforming their lives. So we've done that for many years. And last year, we decided we'd embark upon trying to help families in particular. We know that African-American households, over half, are without a father in the household. And so we try and work to put fathers in particular in touch with their children, even if they're separated or divorced from the mother. We try and get them involved in the lives. In many of the cases, it is that there's a dispute over either money, parenting style, and meaning custody issues. And then there's the issue of paternity. Mm-hmm. Paternity tests cost nearly $1,000 if you want to get an accurate one. So we know that that prohibits a lot of men from and families from establishing themselves. And so we provide that, and we'll continue to do more of that. That's the long story long. Mm-hmm. We're going to continue and accelerate our ability to help families at this point. We're going to continue to help those dealing with drug and alcohol problems as well, but now we're going to shift a lot of focus over to families.
I was going to add, that was my next question. Why is it important to you as a father, but also as an African-American man, to address the importance of men being men and being in lines with their children?
I know firsthand from having been a troubled youth and watching throughout the projects, I guess that statistics certainly apply where I grew up in Herman Gardens, where over half of the households did not have fathers, and this was in the 70s. Right. And most of us who did not have fathers were involved in, were troubled youth, involved in criminal activity. And as I look back and began to learn, as I matured, I concluded, as many studies do, that fatherless homes has a very detrimental effect on boys in particular, because they really don't know real manhood. They mm-hmm. learn manhood, this super macho sense of manhood on the corner from the street guys, and it's destructive, much of it. And so teaching them that, and by the way, we're gonna have parenting classes.
Gotcha.
As well, that I'm going to ask that the litigants attend. That's why it's important to me, and I know that the street gang members, they go because they don't have fathers in their homes, and they're looking for a sense of leadership and manhood to emulate, and unfortunately, it's this twisted sense of manhood, the super macho manhood, in which I challenge a lot of the brothers to be super macho and in the real society and stop punking out and running to the corner. Because a lot of it is fear of engaging real society. And, you know, let get rid of that fear as you do when you're on the street. And go on to the financial aid office and argue with the folks who tell you your money's not coming. Go into the workplace and uplift yourself, educate yourselves, and learn how to deal in the workplace, even when you're not necessarily feeling welcome. So those are the things that I try and inspire, and those are the observations I've made throughout my years.
A couple of more questions, Judge Mathis. Once someone submits a concern or a case to you all, how do you all decide what's going to be, I guess, good television?
Yeah, and I don't know that part, but I do know that that's what they look for. They send researchers around the country,
okay,
to small claim courts, and look up cases that have already been filed, and those that have a entertainment factor,
mm-hmm.
And both parties agree to come on, because we're arbitrators in reality. That's what we are, arbitrators who arbitrate debates, and they must agree to abide by our arbitration opinion once they come before us. They sign an agreement agreeing to do so. So with all that being said, we look for folks who's going to bring a little entertainment, because after all, this is both education and entertainment. If you just want regular law, you go down to your local court and sit in and fall asleep.
When you check, and I say check in a kind way, some of the litigants on your show, is there an additional conversation once the camera stopped that you're trying to get your point across to them?
No, it isn't. No. Okay. I simply end that case and go and prepare for the next. Anything that I'm trying to get across,
you've got it across.
I also want the viewers to come to know as well, or to learn. So there's nothing really left after leaving the bench terms of important things to say.
Are there any memorable programs or moments that really sticks out in these last 19 years?
Yeah, there's one, and it was so many years ago, but it still is very much present for me. And that is, I had a young man that came before me. He had left the street gangs of South Central LA to go and move with his aunt in San Francisco, because both his parents had died from HIV, AIDS. Mm-hmm. And he went there to live with his aunt, and the aunt had a husband who was very abusive toward him, even though he had enrolled in community college and had a little job. And he was 21 or so, and his uncle would dog him and tell him how little or nothing he was, and lock him out if he wasn't in by 11 p.m. And this lawsuit that came before me, the young man was suing because his things had been thrown out by his uncle because he didn't come in by midnight on a Friday, 22-year-old. And so it affected me so much so, because when I began to challenge the uncle about how he should be mentoring this young man who fought his way out of the street gangs, the uncle was just very degrading and demeaning of the young man. And so I demand, the young man won the judgment, clearly, because his things were set out illegally. But then I offered him the opportunity for us to further help him and help him through community college. And then he came back a few years later as a minister in his church, and he had his associate's degree and was doing great things. So that was perhaps the most impactful.
How does it feel to have a street named after you?
Well, I say it's named after my mother, Mathis Lane. It feels great. It feels great. It's an honor to my mother. And I, of course, don't mind a little prestige from it. But it's really an honor to my mother, who died at age 49, and I was 17 at the time. And she is the one who I contribute all my success to, in the sense that she made sure that I focused on my education, even though I was a troubled kid. When I was at home, I had to focus on that education, and she made us go to church as often as she could. Right. And so those are the values that allowed me to overcome the obstacles once I determined I wanted to. And so that's why I named that after her, the Mathis Lane.
How has faith and family been a part of this journey?
Well, you know, it keeps you grounded, that's for sure. I, you know, I'm still called on to do the menial things. And four kids that, you know, treat me like a regular dad and don't cut any corners as it relates to being teenagers, as they were. And now they're all adults and lawyers and producers, et cetera. But the other part was the ability to provide opportunity for my children to obtain the best that society has to offer. One of the things I'll point out to you, and then I don't know what your time is looking like, but one short story is regarding presenting the best opportunity that my children could have. I, as a Detroit advocate, as you know, it was important to remain in the city as city leaders, et cetera. So when I was able to come on television and could afford a significant residence, for lack of a better term, we moved out to an area, the Bloomfield Hills, you probably know of.
Yes, I do.
Top community in Michigan. And so I was doing a interview with People Magazine, and in between the questioning, they said, well, you live out here in this prestigious community, and not many African Americans are here, and do you feel somehow that you sold out? I said, no, I feel that I sold up. I said that Dr. King worked and gave his life and spoke of us living with equal opportunity. And I told her I thought that Dr. King would appreciate that me and my family now live in one of the most prestigious communities in the country. I said, I'm doing just what Dr. King would want, us to take advantage of every resource and the best resources that this country has to offer.
I understand. Final question, Judge Mathis. How can we get young people, like it or not, that this is our justice system and we need to work within that system and not outside of it?
Well, depends on what you mean by outside. Outside the system to me means that you're still operating in a legal manner,
right.
But you're just working outside of mainstream. Your agenda and your tactics may be a little more militant. So I think that's an acceptable way of fighting, because sometimes those who we're fighting, they will move toward a more conventional change, but nonetheless, they move toward a more conventional change because they don't want to deal with the militant approach. And so I think both sides are effective, and working within the system in many instances means becoming a lawyer and defending those who are unlawfully being charged and are also being racially profiled, et cetera. So that's one way within the system. And also, when you come before a judge, you should ask for that second chance and pledge to the judge that you're going to empower yourself and stop a destructive lifestyle. So those are the two things I think we can do as youth to advance the cause.
The Honorable Greg Mathis, former Superior Court Judge for Michigan 36th District Court and host of the long-run reality TV courtroom program, Judge Mathis. I would like to thank KNTU for their assistance in the production of this program. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions at your future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.